Jack took this as a chance to move in, noiselessly slipping lower so that he was able to launch himself downward from behind, hoping to take the man out without giving him a chance to use the blowpipe. Jack could feel the small dart.
Ah, shit!
He pulled it out, throwing it to one side. He'd neglected the other men in the hunting party, forgetting them momentarily. It would cost him. Going numb and his vision clouding, Jack knew he was done for. He could only hope that the dart was nothing more than a tranquilizer. JB was sweating. His patience had already been stretched far too thin by Doc, let alone to wait for an enemy that refused to show. Every sound, every movement of wildlife put him on a hair trigger. When the time came, though, it was as if all that pressure slipped away, and he locked into a calmer frame of mind. There was only one thing he could do, take the initiative. Using his survival skills, JB moved out from his position, keeping low and moving toward a conspicuous shrub. He made the distance between last cover and the shrub, going into a roll to come up to the rear of the purple blooms, his Uzi raised. The space behind the shrub, which he felt sure harbored the enemy, was empty. It was only when he heard the faintest movement behind him that he realized he had been fooled. He felt the prick of the dart in the back of his neck. Before he could turn, the world spun on its axis and started to darken. Christy knew there was danger here. Her sixth sense was tying her stomach in knots. But that was good. She remembered Mother Sonia explaining to her that this gift was to preserve life, to give due warning of potential danger. She shifted uncomfortably. She felt that she was in good cover, but something was wrong, and if she didn't move soon, it would be too late. She grasped her .38 Smith & Wesson in both hands. Every fiber of her body was screaming for her to move. She could see nothing, hear nothing around her to suggest she was in danger. She identified another patch of cover she could move to. As she edged out, she realized why her senses had been screaming at her. One of the enemy party rose up out of tree and shrub cover directly in front of her, waiting patiently for her to show herself, knowing she was there. Christy leveled her blaster. The shot went high and wide, her aim ruined by the dart that caught her in the chest, the impact making her jerk at the last. She steadied her hand for a second round, but couldn't stop the world from spinning. Ryan heard Christy's shot and fixed his attention on the direction it came from. There was no follow-up, no further sounds of a struggle. Ryan didn't want to betray his own position, but he couldn't in all conscience leave Christy to it. The one-eyed man had never been afraid of taking chances. It was the only way he'd managed to survive. All risks were calculated. Some were just more so than others. Slipping from cover, Ryan made his way through the undergrowth. Although he was looking for Christy, it wasn't long before he could see Mildred slumped on the turf. He couldn't tell if she was breathing. She was in the open, and he would have to break cover. If she was down, then what the hell had happened to Christy after she had fired that lone round? He paused, checking the surrounding area. It was deathly quiet. The fact that he seemed to be the only one of his people to respond was worrisome, but that could wait. Shouldering the Steyr and drawing the six-hour, Ryan glanced around one more time before taking a deep breath and moving out into the open. Mildred was face down. He turned her over. Ryan heard movement behind him. Working on pure instinct and adrenaline, he rolled away from Mildred and in the opposite direction to the sound, snapping off a shot from the Sig Sauer to give himself some kind of covering fire. But even as he was in mid-roll, he heard more movement, this time in front of him. He couldn't stop, couldn't adjust himself. He felt the dart hit him. With his good eye, he caught a glimpse of a woman, half hidden by the leaves, a blowpipe still raised to her lips. He kept rolling, unable to stop himself, as the world began to lurch beneath him. They were trussed like hogs and carried to the ville. The two hunting parties convened. A brief description of the humiliation the original hunters had suffered made the patrol sorry that they hadn't killed the strangers.
No, save them for Eric. He'll have plans for them, I'm sure. First, we gotta get this scum back to Yule Town.
The two hunting parties shouldered their burdens and made their way along trodden paths to the small fishing village. Yule Town was hardly large enough to be called a ville. A series of timber huts and shacks, it could support no more than a couple hundred inhabitants. Despite their seeming isolation, they were of a relatively healthy stock, with evidence of a wide gene pool. They relied on fishing the bay by which they lived and the waters beyond out into the reaches of the sea surrounding the swamplands that lay across the bay. Isolated by land due to the dense woods and the desert that sat beyond, they were able to trade via the waters, and the influx of other fishers and traders by sea gave them the opportunity to avoid the inbreeding that had degenerated so many other small isolated communities. However, they were also fairly poverty-stricken. The fishing stock had dried up in recent months, leaving them no basic diet beyond the small amount of crops they could raise on land reclaimed from the woods and whatever fruits they could find. Unfortunately, the toxic nature of the soil meant that most of the fruit was inedible and accounted for the sparsity of land they could use for farming. That had never been a problem before, as the rich fishing stocks had left them plenty to trade with. Until now, when a school of predators, unseen but running deep and occasionally ripping nets, had started to deplete the bay. Now there was little trade and little food, which sent complete novices into the woods to hunt small game. They were fishermen, not hunters. Word had spread to the village by the time that the hunters arrived with their trussed captives, still unconscious from the darts. Families watched from their doorways as the captives were taken past the dwellings, down to the docks, where the wooden boardwalks extended out to the docks for the fishing ships.
Think they may be coming around soon. Some of them, at any rate.
Christy tentatively opened an eye, peering at the painful light. She flexed her arms and found them almost numb. Her legs were the same. As she gained better use of her faculties, she realized she was tied securely. More and more, she adjusted to the light. She was trussed and bound to a pole that had been laid horizontally on some kind of perch. Moving her head, and neck movement was about all the secure binding gave her, she could see that she was on the end of a row. Five other poles, on which were placed Ryan, J.B., Mildred, Doc, and Jack, all of them as securely bound as herself, and they were all facing the sun. There was little else she could see except for the water, and a large group of angry-looking people.
Hell, looks like they're coming around. The redhead sure is.
Straining, Christy could see that the one who had spoken was a woman with a string of bullets slung across her ample chest. She had a fat man beside her, and his eyes bored into Christie's as they met. He would kill her as soon as look at her if he could. But why put them on display? Why not just kill them and have done with it? A face loomed over her. It was thin, hatchet-like, and sparsely covered with gray hair. The face was weathered and lined. The eyes were cobalt blue.
Well, looks like they're all ready. Guess you should know what's gonna happen to you and why. I'll tell you what. Maybe another time things would have been different. Trouble is, if we weren't so desperate for food, none of us would have been out there in the first place.
Christy opened her mouth and tried to speak. She was surprised that the others had remained silent. Lynn discovered why. She was still paralyzed. She tried to move her fingers and toes and found that they wouldn't respond. So feeling was returning, but only gradually.
We're a fishing village. You can't catch much when you've got some triple big bastards eating all your catch. We need to lure them up to the surface where we can chill them and let things get back to normal. Best way that I can figure to do that is give them some fresh bait. Give them something good and big to feed on. Make sure you get some blood in the water to give them the scent. All we have to do is get you ready and haul you out. Perfect. Oh, by the way, those tranquilizers won't be wearing off anytime soon. Been harvested from the local trees made toxic by the soil. A dart usually paralyzes for 3 hours. You've had just over 1.5, so you should be ready to thrash about and spread that blood and water come the time. Avenge your pride all you want, boys, but remember, we want them alive.
Christy twisted her head to look and wished that she hadn't. The hunters they had encountered stepped closer, carrying razor-sharp blades, curved for skinning animals. And Christy felt like an animal. An old childhood ditty ran through Mildred's head, a trick of the mind to try to distract in times of distress. It was an old couplet, a song from when she was still an intern. Something that guy Rob, who was in her pathology class, used to play in his car all the time. Some kind of long hair shit when she was listening to Rick James. She hadn't thought of it in years, except that it made a lot of sense all of a sudden. Some piece of junk hidden in the recess of her memory, and coming out now that it was appropriate. Part of her mind was rambling through this, and the other part was a silent scream, pain and terror with no outlet, as her paralyzed voice could not give vent. It was the same for all of them. Lying prone and defenseless, they had been unable to do anything to prevent the inept hunters from taking revenge on them while preparing them for the sacrifice. The inhabitants of Yule Town had clustered around the six poles, using the paring knives to slice through their clothes, not reducing them to ribbons, but making small cuts and tears, almost with an air of precision. The cuts were designed to break the skin, slicing across the surface to open wide cuts that were shallow and oozed blood in small trickles. The cuts were maddening. Taking the very nerve endings at the surface of the skin, they were sharp and insistent pains, halfway between the sting of a deep cut and an itch, doing little more but inspire the desire to scratch, something they were unable to do. While the villagers worked in them, the old man called Leroy and the woman Colette, who had been among the villagers bringing in the companions, had gathered together their outer clothes, backpacks, and the bag in which JB carried their ammo and explosives. They hadn't bothered to check the contents, not caring what the bags contained. They had another concern.
Eric, a word?
As the hatchet-faced elder of Yule Town walked away, anyone stumbling upon the scene would have assumed that another catch from the sea was being calmly gutted.
They're things. What shall we do with them?
Does it matter, Leroy? Colette?
Not sure. Me and Leroy have been talking about it. They seem to come from out of nowhere, and they ain't part of no convoy that's trying to get past the desert. But maybe there are others looking for them, and maybe those others wouldn't take too kindly to our chilling them in such a manner.
Good point. Guess you're right about that. We should get rid of them where they can't be found. Weigh them down and dump them after we've got rid of these mutants.
Leroy and Colette assented, and Eric walked back to where the travelers were being bloodied for bait.
They ready yet?
Hard to tell when they can't scream.
Tell you what, leave them be for the time being. We don't want them so far gone that they don't move about in the water. The more they thrash, the more they'll churn up that blood smell and attract what we're hunting for.
Under Eric's direction, the villagers stepped back, their knives disappearing. The companions were left lying on their poles, breathing as heavily as the paralyzing effects of the toxin would allow, but still unable to utter a sound. 12 of the villagers, 2 per pole, took hold of them and removed them from the perch, walking down the dock to where a fishing boat lay at anchor. There were several boats moored around the bay, but this one had been rigged up for a specific purpose. There were 6 lines running from it, made of a thickly woven hemp. The poles, with their bloody cargo, were dropped roughly onto the dock, and 6 metal rings were driven into the head of each pole with sledgehammers. Once this was done, and the rings tested for strength, the ropes from the fishing boat were passed, 1 through each ring, and securely tied. Now the boat was ready to cast off. The crew made ready to sail out into the bay, watched by the silent villagers. For one heart-stopping moment, Ryan believed they were going to be dragged behind the ship to their destination. The ship's unofficial captain was looking over the human bait and saw the look of horror in Ryan's eyes.
Don't be stupid, Outlander. We want you alive for the monsters. They don't go after what's dead. Load them up!
The crew took up Ryan and his people once more and tossed them carelessly at the stern of the boat. The human woodpile collapsed in a haphazard collection of bruises, cuts. Eric had seen fit to use half of what they had caught in the woods as trailing bait. The dead animal's blood would hopefully get the attention of their quarry, and the live bait would keep them occupied long enough to slaughter. It was a risk, sacrificing that much food, but the chance to replenish their waters with fish was too great to ignore. The ship set off at once. Ryan struggled for consciousness. Between the tranquilizer and the blood loss, he was groggy at best. Jack was somewhat better off, a little more clear-headed. Whether it was a result of his years of survival training, his metabolism, or some error in dosage, he recognized feeling coming back into his limbs. He wriggled his fingers to experiment and found them responsive. The captain and his crew, secure in the belief that the human bait was subdued, went about the task of getting underway, paying the companions no mind. Jack used their distracted attention to focus on the bonds tying his wrists. The blood so greedily cut by the humiliated hunters had possibly been a blessing. The rope was slick with it, and its purchase on his hands was weaker for it. With a great deal of effort, He was able to slip a hand from its knot completely. Desperately, he tugged at the rope securing his other hand until both were free. Jack risked a cautious eye towards the crew. They were still completely engrossed in their tasks. He looked to his left and found Christy struggling to regain lucidity. Still bound at the feet and gripping the pole, he rolled over towards her, colliding into her. Pressed up against her, he scrambled to untie her hands.
Sorry, Christy. Hope you forgive me later.
He shot her a wink, seeing the gratitude in her eyes. With her hands free, they could both work to free the others. Jack tightened his calves and thighs, sliding himself down the pole to be nearer his feet. He didn't dare bend or seem in any way to be untied. There were too many of them for him to take on his own. Precious seconds were spent loosening the knots at his feet to where he would be able to slide out of them at a moment's notice. Ryan was next, while Christy desperately worked at Mildred's bonds. Shortly, Mildred and Christy, who were the closest to the pole in which Doc was still secured, signaled their intent to try to free the old man. They went to work on Doc's bonds as he lay against the pole, muttering to himself, lost in some strange world of his own. On the deck, the seven-man crew that had been chosen by Eric to pilot and man the vessel on its journey was trying to relax before it had to tackle its enemy. A single woman, Colette, who had been in the hunting party, and six men were on board. The members of the crew were at the prow, armed with remade Heckler & Koch MP5s, flare guns, and scavenged air pressure harpoons. They had no idea if the SMGs would be of any use against the creatures, knew that the flares would be explosively effective if they hit at close range, and trusted their fishing skills to use the harpoons when the creatures came in range. They were watching the waters ahead, apprehension churning in their guts. All were hoping that the bait they dragged in their wake would attract the school. And as they saw the dark shapes move in the water and start to cluster at the wake of the boat's backwash, they snapped out of their relaxation and primed their weapons. The companions' belongings and blasters, weighted and ready to be dumped overboard as per the orders of Eric, sat neglected in the corner. There had been too much to consider on the way out. In much the same way, the crew hadn't thought to check what was happening to the bait they trailed behind them. If they gave it any thought at all, it was merely to wonder if they would still be alive when the predators came in to take them. If they were, then their thrashing in the waters would stir up the bloodlust of the school and attract them all to the one area for a cleaner kill from the fishermen.